Hey everybody, it's time for your Thursday Takeaway on September 14th, 2017.
Welcome to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick. It's good to be with you today. We start in Florida, where President Trump is surveying the damage caused by Hurricane Irma. Remnants of the storm continue to make their way north, but many Floridians remain without power even today, and state officials report that thousands are still in shelters. Meanwhile, it was reported Wednesday that 8 people died in a Florida nursing home left without air conditioning after Hurricane Irma. It's a reminder that storms may not discriminate when they make landfall, but people do. And the country's most vulnerable people often fare the worst when disaster strikes. Miami-Dade County in South Florida suffered the highest number of power outages after the hurricane hit. It's also plagued by income inequality. More than 20% of Miami-Dade residents live below the poverty line. Joan Phlox is with the Center for Governmental Responsibility at the University of Florida Levin College of Law.
I think that the same indicators that make people vulnerable on a socioeconomic scale make them more vulnerable in a hurricane. So, for example, take a low-income population. And you can look at it at different phases of a hurricane. So the preparation, low-income people don't have resources to maybe afford supplies. They may not have the resources to evacuate, for example, money for gas, money for lodging. They may not have transportation. If they shelter in place, then they may not have stable or secure housing that can withstand a disaster like a hurricane. They may be disproportionately located in flood zones. They may be in places where there's less infrastructure, like drainage. They may be living near places that have high locations of industry or contamination. And some of the same socioeconomic factors may make it more difficult for them to recover as well. Resources to repair or rebuild, lack of insurance. If they're not homeowners, it may be that they don't even have a place to return to. Their employment may be affected by a hurricane. If they're in the service industry, they may not have a place to go back to work, like the restaurant that might have been affected. Or if their agricultural workers in the fields have been flooded, they may not have a job to go back to. So all of those things, a lot of them which are resource-linked, make it difficult for low-income people to withstand a hurricane.
Joan Phlox, talk about the difficulty of evacuation and return itself. If people live in neighborhoods where there's less transportation and they have fewer cars or less access to cars, it seems like the order to evacuate or even the desire to evacuate would be a much more complicated decision.
I think that low-income people and other vulnerable groups are the groups that end up using mass shelters more often. And some of this may be just due to a lack of choice, a lack of the transportation to evacuate, or the money for gas, or the ability to pay for lodging once they get out. So a lot of people may have no choice but to shelter in place.
Joan Phlox, one of the key issues here seems to be that as states and even the federal government do disaster planning, and we hear about it all the time, after major storms, the planning for the future starts anew. Are states like Florida taking their sizable low-income populations into account when they plan for the next disaster? Is that even happening?
I think that to help vulnerable groups like low-income people and elderly and immigrants to withstand hurricanes and other disasters, it's important that we work all the time to reduce the factors that make them vulnerable in the first place. I don't think that that is necessarily the role for our emergency operation centers or our disaster managers. I think that is the role of all of us, of the citizens of the state, all the time. These are long-term solutions that we should be working on. An example of that is our housing stock and the fact that Florida ranks very, very low among states for affordable and accessible housing. If people are forced to live in substandard housing or even outdoors in places that can barely withstand just a daily environment in Florida, much less a hurricane, that's something that we need to be working on all the time and not just because a crisis is looming.
Joan Phlox, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Todd.
Joan Phlox is with the Center for Governmental Responsibility at the University of Florida Levin College of Law. There are some new numbers out this week from the U.S. Census Bureau on income, poverty, and health insurance. And those numbers show an American middle class on the rise. According to the data, the middle class in 2016 had its highest earning year ever recorded. U.S. poverty is down, and fewer people are without health insurance. That's all good news, for sure. But according to many analysts, it is not time to celebrate. Heather Long is here with the Washington Post. She's an economics reporter. She's here to break down some of the numbers for us in these latest data. Heather, welcome.
Hi, Todd.
So big picture, how are the middle class doing in this report from the U.S. Census Bureau?
Well, the good news is incomes are finally rising at a pretty decent pace after about two decades of stagnation. So the report this week showed that a typical middle class family is now bringing home just over $59,000. You can debate if that sounds like a lot or not, but the important point is it's finally more than what middle class families were bringing home in 1999. So we no longer have to party like it's 1999.
So families are making more, and finally you have an increase after many, what was that, 18 years of stagnation in that regard. But income is up. What about prices? What can you buy for the money?
Oh, good question. I should have mentioned that that is actually a number that is adjusted for inflation. So it's adjusted for prices rising for housing or food costs going up. So it's easy for us to compare that number to the 1999 number.
Okay, so you can indeed buy a little bit more with that $59,000 and change. Is there some good news embedded in the big numbers for any different groups, different types of income earners in the middle class?
Well, there's good news and bad news in this report. The good news is we're finally going in the right direction. And almost every demographic group, with the exception of the elderly, saw people over 65. Pretty much every other generation and every other racial group did see a pretty sizable uptick in the past 2 years. So again, good news from that. The downside is we still have huge disparities, particularly by race in this country. So we talked about a typical middle class family in the U.S. earning $59,000, while an African American family is only earning about $39,000, and a Hispanic family is only about $47,000. So we still have a long way to go to close these gaps and ensure that everyone in the country can benefit from a stronger economy.
So big gaps, inequality persists. What about inequality based on income itself? Are there still as many people moving into the middle class and moving into the upper middle class that we used to have?
You're right. That is not as encouraging. Most of the gains in income in the United States are going to the top. So we saw a record number last year, a record amount of the pie, if you will. The economic pie is now going to the top 20% of Americans. So that means that money could have gone potentially to middle class or to the working poor. And instead, more and more of the amount of our economy, what we're producing, is going to the super top. And that's very concerning. It's concerning for the economy. It could hold us back in the long term.
You talk about middle class incomes. That's one way to look at income. But we also talk about wages across the economy. What's in the numbers about wages?
So here's what we know. It's a little bit hard to reconcile, but I'll try to break it down. And that's, even though we're seeing incomes, household incomes go up to $59,000, the reason that's happening is because more and more people are getting back to full-time jobs. So what we saw just last year alone was over 2 million people re-entered the workforce and they got full-time jobs. And so that's why we saw household incomes rising, because now people who weren't working before are working now. So of course, that's helping to lift earnings. But what about the people who already had jobs? For the millions and millions of Americans who were already in the workforce, they have not been seen their wages increase. And so that's why it's taken almost 20 years to recover from where we were in the late 1990s.
So Heather Long, I have to say, there, you mentioned at the top there is some good news that middle class household incomes are finally over the level where they were in 1999. And for sure that has to be good news. But then all of the other factors that you're talking about, for people in the workforce, wages are stagnated. There are classes classes, there's still inequality throughout these classes, not only based on race, but most of the income gains are still going to the top. They're not going to the middle class, even though the middle class is doing finally a little bit better than it was in 1999. And to me, the good news that you're bringing here sounds like the car's in first gear finally for the middle class. And that's about it.
I think that's a good way to put it. And one of the experts I talked to, he said to me, this better not be as good as it gets. And that's kind of my takeaway. So we're finally seeing some turnaround here. Like you said, it was encouraging that some of the fastest gains last year went to African-American households who have really struggled. They're still not better off than they were in 1999. So we're seeing some encouraging uptick. But just like you said, it better get a lot better than this or people are going to remain very frustrated that they can't better their standard of living.
And meanwhile, in Washington, before we let you go, Heather, Americans are looking for major tax reform, heavy on corporate tax cuts. What should they be thinking when they see that news compared to the news that you're bringing today on economic data?
I think we have to keep asking the question that you're asking, which, what's in this tax package for the middle class and for the working poor? We saw really interesting comments from the president this week where he said he would be willing to not do any tax cuts at all, maybe even raise taxes on the wealthy in order to give more of a tax break to the middle class. So we're starting to see some potential deal making. Again, we've got a long way to go. There's no details on paper yet, but that's the question we have to keep pressing the White House on.
The good news in new census data for the middle class, the car is finally starting to lurch forward out of the ditch. Heather Long, economics correspondent for the Washington Post. Thanks, Heather.
Thank you.
Okay, so the census says the middle class is on the rise, but are you feeling it? Are you making more than you were last year? What about compared to before the recession?
This is Sharon from Charleston, South Carolina, and I make considerably more than I did last year because I now work two jobs, a full-time position in academia and then a part-time position in the automotive industry.
My name is Christine. I'm calling from Akron, Ohio. I work part-time for the federal government and I will make approximately the same as I have for the last 2 years. As for before the recession, I am making less.
I'm Jennifer Trotter and I'm from Drain, Oregon. I'm definitely making less. Much less than last year. In fact, I don't know how I'm going to make it through the winter.
We got a message on Facebook from Michael who says, I personally earned more last year than ever before, but the raise didn't make much difference. It seemed like the same point could be made about the middle class overall. The increase is minuscule. And we got this message from a listener in Austin, Texas. This data can't be true. Could this data be skewed in some way? I have a scientific graduate degree and I can't find a job. Is my story unique? Well, does that story sound unique to you? How are your earnings compared to last year or before the recession? Call us, 8778-MYTAKE, and you can always tweet us, at The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Indeed.com, where business owners and HR professionals can post job openings, review candidates, take notes, and schedule interviews from an online dashboard. Learn more at Indeed.com. And Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for businesses, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage, and more. More details at Staples stores or staples.com/copy and print. Staples, it's pro time.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. In Myanmar now, where the military's crackdown on the Rohingya is being called an ethnic cleansing, propped up by modern-day concentration camps. The Rohingya are a Muslim minority in Myanmar, and more than 400,000 Rohingya have fled to neighboring Bangladesh since the end of August. Myanmar appeared to be heading toward a more democratic future with the election of Nobel Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi as national leader in 2016. Suu Kyi is now facing criticism, though, for failing to intervene in this persecution, and she's not expected to attend the UN General Assembly this week in New York. But that new democracy in Myanmar could also be part of the problem here. That's according to Nicholas Kristof, author and columnist for The New York Times. Nick visited Myanmar in 2015 to report on the situation with the Rohingya, and he joins me now. Nick, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Good to be back with you.
When you were in Myanmar in 2015, you saw the conditions there, you saw the camps, and I know you're following the situation now, Nick. Describe some of those conditions, the health conditions, the food and water, and the situation that people are living under.
So essentially, the Rohingya have been locked up either in quasi-concentration camps if they're in more urban areas or confined to their villages if they're in more rural areas. And that means that they cannot go out to school. And most importantly, that they can't get medical care. So if a woman is in obstructed labor, then she cannot go to a hospital to get a C-section or cannot easily, there occasionally are some provisions, but in general, she cannot get outside medical help. And humanitarian groups have also been pretty much blocked from providing support for the Rohingya. And so you have crushing mortality and other really desperate conditions. And then it's on top of that, you've had the latest crackdown and villages burned, this kind of thing.
Yeah, we've seen news photographs and reports recently of villagers, Rohingya villagers, watching from across fields while entire villages burn. Is that widespread?
You know, nobody is allowed in Rakhine State where this is happening. And our only real information comes from a combination of interviews with Rohingya refugees who have fled and also from satellite images that show villages burning. But every bit of information we get suggests that the Myanmar military has systematically gone through and burned villages, in some cases slaughtered inhabitants, raped women. The Myanmar military itself is now estimated that almost 40% of the Rohingya villages have been completely abandoned. This is a major population in this part of Burma, and they are fleeing because of this systematic ethnic cleansing undertaken by the Myanmar military and, of course, all unfolding under a Nobel Peace Prize winner.
I want to play you some sound, Nick, from your trip in Myanmar. This is Yu Win Myang, a state government spokesman, when you asked him about the plight of the Rohingya.
The first thing I want to say is when you are here in our state, don't use the word Rohingya. There's no such thing as the Rohingya ethnicity in our country.
Nick Kristof, here's a government spokesperson that you talked to saying flat out that the Rohingya ethnicity doesn't even exist in the first place.
The ethnic cleansing and brutality towards the Rohingya is based on denial of their rights, but also denial of their existence. And it's kind of staggering that even Aung San Suu Kyi doesn't use the word Rohingya. It makes it very hard to have a conversation with Myanmar officials about it. The Myanmar government claims that these are relatively recent illegal immigrants from Bangladesh. They call them Bengalis. And this is just a completely false narrative. There are ancient accounts from the 18th century, for example, that show that the Rohingya were already well established at that time. The notion that they are illegal immigrants in recent decades is just preposterous. But that is used as a way to deny them citizenship, deny them rights.
Nick, the world celebrated the election of Aung San Suu Kyi in Myanmar in 2016 and the democratic reforms that came along with it. There were benefits from the United States and other Western democracies that came along with that. But you've said that these democratic reforms have fueled some of the ethnic hatreds and may have made this situation worse. Why did you say that?
It's really sad to see the evolution of democracy in Myanmar in some ways. The old fault line was between those who had supported the military dictatorship and those who were supporting democracy. And by that fault line, then the forces of democracy were and human rights were triumphant. But increasingly, the fault line in politics in Myanmar is about how much do we hate Muslim minorities, especially the Rohingya. And that has empowered the darkest forces in Myanmar. And I think that it's one reason why Aung San Suu Kyi has been on the wrong side of this. I mean, my take is that she genuinely does see many of the Rohingya as troublemakers and in some cases as illegal immigrants. But I also think that she has moved from being this incredible human rights icon to a pragmatic politician, and that she knows that if she were to speak up for this enormously unpopular minority, that it would hurt her political party. And I think that's a factor in not just her silence, but she has actively been defending and what is going on, which is just so painful for all of us who so admired Aung San Suu Kyi.
Is the United States the country that could put a stop to this, or are there other countries as well?
I think it'll take a global pressure. But the U.S., this would be a really important place for the U.S. to exercise real leadership, partly because the U.S. was so important in bringing Myanmar out of the cold under the Obama administration, partly because Suu Kyi cares very, very deeply about her relationship with the U.S., because the Myanmar military has been rebuilding ties with the U.S. And so I think that while the entire world and regional powers matter a great deal, I think this is a place for U.S. leadership, and so far we have not seen that.
Nicholas Kristof, author and columnist for The New York Times. Nick, thanks for being with us again.
Good to be with you, Todd.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick, and we turn out of Washington, where there appears to be some kind of deal that could preserve the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA. Last night, the Democratic leaders, Senator Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, released a statement saying that after meeting with President Trump, they had, quote, agreed to enshrine the protections in DACA into law very quickly and to work out a package of border security, excluding the wall, that's acceptable to both sides, end quote. Now, this morning, the president affirmed that he would support a deal like that, that he'd be willing to put major resources toward border security, enshrine DACA, but not towards his signature wall, at least not right now. Now, that last part has enraged some very vocal members of the president's political base. We have Tara Palmieri here. She's White House correspondent for Politico. Hi, Tara.
Hi.
First of all, this deal, what really happened here, and is it the kind of deal that can get passed by Congress?
It could pass as long as the president can get a few Republicans on his side, which shouldn't be so hard because they are the same party. Let's not forget that what he's asking for, increased border security, is something that Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan have been calling for. You know, they have not been such hardliners on the wall. It will really be the conservatives in the Republican Party that he might lose, but he doesn't really need them if he gets all the Democratic votes.
Right. So President Trump has been a champion of this wall all through the campaign. At times, right, he said the wall just got 10 feet higher. It just got 10 feet higher. What has the reaction been like among his political base that this deal got made that would allow 800,000 DACA recipients to stay in this country and no wall?
Well, that's something that the conservative base is very angry about. You saw Congressman Stephen King this morning saying that this is the exact same agenda that Hillary Clinton would have had. And the other issue is that you see on Breitbart, which was a huge advocate of Donald Trump's, Amnesty Don, that was the headline this morning. So he's already facing backlash from conservatives who are still angry about the debt ceiling deal that he did with Nancy and Chuck, or Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer,
right,
last week.
Well, let's talk about the president's relationship with Nancy and Chuck here. Here are the voices of some of the players. Here's the president.
If you look at some of the greatest legislation ever passed, it was done on a bipartisan manner. And so that's what we're going to give it a shot, right, Tom? And we'll see what we can do. And if it works out, great. And if it doesn't work out, great. Hopefully we'll be able to do it anyway as Republicans.
And then here was the Democratic leader, Nancy Pelosi, vilified by the right at her podium today.
We have votes. I have no question that if we put the bill on the floor, it would win. And for these and other reasons, I believe that the president, because of conviction, but because of reality, is there for the Dreamers.
Tara Palmieri, can Paul Ryan risk crossing the conservatives in his House conference and putting this on the floor?
It's a very difficult situation that the president has put Paul Ryan in. But you have to remember, Trump is still annoyed with Paul Ryan about the health care debacle. He feels like he hasn't done enough to push his legislative agenda. And aides close to Trump tell me a little bit of this is motivated by the fact that he's kind of annoyed with Mitch and Paul right now. It only takes one vote to, you know, call a referendum on his leadership.
A possible bipartisan deal that could protect recipients of the DREAM Act in exchange for some border security and some big political risks now for Republican leaders on Capitol Hill. Tara Palmieri of Politico, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's stay on immigration and go to California now, where on Monday, state lawmakers reached a deal to make California a so-called sanctuary state. The deal would bar police and sheriffs from asking about a person's immigration status. It also prohibits them from honoring detainer requests from federal immigration authorities. The bill is expected to pass in California's assembly this week, and it's all happening while the Justice Department says it will hold back grant money from any jurisdiction that makes itself a sanctuary city. Well, California wants to be a sanctuary state. Marisa Lagos is political reporter for KQED in San Francisco, and she explains what this law would mean.
Yeah, so, I mean, this deal is the result of months of negotiation between law enforcement and the governor and lawmakers who really wanted to just all out bar any contact or cooperation with immigration and customs enforcement. The deal reached Monday essentially says they can't hold people in jail specifically for ICE to pick them up if they would otherwise be released. That's actually not something most sheriffs are doing right now anyway in this area because of a court decision that said that could raise constitutional concerns about, you know, unlawfully holding somebody. But it could matter if that is overturned. I think the bigger thing that the sheriffs are, than the reason the sheriffs are still opposed to this, is it basically says that unless someone has been convicted of one of some 800 crimes, mostly felonies, in the last 15 years, they can't communicate with ICE at all. So that means when you get booked into a jail, your fingerprints get run and sent to the feds anyway. So they know you're there. But, you know, the sheriff couldn't pick up the phone and say, hey, Marisa gets out on Tuesday if you want to pick her up before then, assuming I didn't have a criminal record. And so, you know, the sheriffs are basically still crying foul, saying that this is impeding their ability to protect communities.
California is a state and an assembly that's controlled by Democrats. Why was there a deal here at all? And why didn't the forces who want to just stick it to the Justice Department push it through?
You know, I think the governor is the main reason. Jerry Brown is sort of famously all over the map on in certain issues, I guess you could say. He has a lot of respect for the sheriffs. He's had a good working relationship with them as he's pushed his own criminal justice reforms in California. And I think he deferred to their judgment on this. You're right. When this bill came out, it really was a stick it to Trump. It actually came out in December. The president of the Senate's original plan was to get it through immediately on a supermajority vote and have it go into effect right away. That got stalled. And so I think that what we really saw was the governor coming to the table in the last like 3 weeks or so and his staff and saying, look, you know, we're not going to sign this unless we reach some sort of agreement.
So they dialed it back a little bit, but there's still some interplay here with the Trump administration and the Justice Department. Marisa, how is the AG Jeff Sessions been reacting to the nation's largest state becoming a sanctuary state? Is there fear of retaliation in California?
I would say that among law enforcement agencies who have benefited from the grants that we're talking about, that the Justice Department has, you know, threatened to cut off, there is concern. I think more broadly on the state level, I mean, what the president of the Senate, Kevin DeLeon, has said is like, we don't grovel for a couple million dollars. So I think it was more this issue of making sure that, you know, that police can sort of protect their communities. We haven't heard a reaction from Sessions this week. In the past, he said, yes, this is a sanctuary bill and this would fall under our definition. You know, those cases are still playing out in court. California has already joined one of the cases with San Francisco, who, you know, is already under the law considered a sanctuary state. So I think it depends. I don't expect that we'll see that Jeff Sessions say, oh, this is more nuanced. So, you know, go ahead with your sort of pushback on our policies.
Marisa Lagos with KQED in San Francisco. Thanks, Marisa.
My pleasure.
This is Todd Zwillick. It's good to be with you on The Takeaway today. We want to revisit now a legal case that we've been following in our partnership with the Marshall Project and their series Case in Point. These cases look at the criminal justice system in America, where it functions well, where it doesn't, and where it doesn't have clear answers. Victor Rosario was imprisoned for 32 years in Massachusetts for setting a fire that killed 8 people. His conviction was overturned in 2014 after new science undercut the testimony of fire experts at his trial. Victor spent the last 3 years waiting to see if his case would be retried. And last week, the Massachusetts District Attorney, Mariah Ryan, said Rosario won't be retried, saying in a statement that the decision did not operate as an acquittal of charges, but that the evidence would not sustain a burden of proof at a new trial. Andrew Cohen is the senior editor at the Marshall Project and author of Case in Point, and he explains.
It does not tell us that Victor Rosario has been exonerated of these long ago crimes. There's no finding from a judge. There's no confession from a prosecutor that says that another person may have done it. There's no a formal finding in the Massachusetts justice system that says here is an innocent man. Having said that, it's also clear that there is not nearly enough evidence to go forward with a re-prosecution of him. So he's in sort of that gray area where he knows he's not going to be prosecuted again. But the state can still say that this wasn't a case where there has been an exoneration.
Now, as for Victor Rosario, he's maintained his innocence and he's been out of prison since the case was overturned. He says the decision feels like a weight being lifted off his shoulders.
It feels like really that's what you call freedom. See, this is freedom. We can define freedom and say that this is a freedom, but that's what I felt.
The district attorney who was in charge of your case late last week issued a statement on why you weren't going to be retried. She said the decision does not operate as an acquittal of charges, but that they've determined that it's in the interest of justice and fairness to proceed in this manner, meaning to not give you a new trial. That is not a statement of your innocence, and there hasn't been any unequivocal evidence of your innocence. There's certainly been questions about the quality of the evidence against you. And it makes me need to ask you, did you do this crime? Are you innocent?
I am innocent, and I would die innocent because that's who I am, an innocent man that was incarcerated for 32 years, and I continue to be innocent. I had many times I had the opportunity even to go to parole and to go and to play the game, but that's not me.
When you say you had an opportunity to play the game for parole, what does that mean?
The parole board, the only thing they want is just to a person to take responsibility for his actions and to show remorse. How a person that is an innocent man can show remorse for something that he never did.
You made several appeals over the years based on arson science, fire science, saying that the original testimony that fire experts gave about the nature of this fire just couldn't be true. Talk about that.
You know, my first lawyer had the opportunity to have having somebody to investigate. Okay, and they never even considered to listen to the defense side of arson. They never considered that. They never even bring me even a person to do the work that need to be done to examine the evidence, to examine if it was arson or was an accident. They even never did that.
Well, Victor, during the time that you were incarcerated, the science of fire investigation really changed. The kind of testimony that the fire experts gave in your trial, oh, this must have been liquid accelerant because we can see this evidence, that type of analysis changed. New fire science and new fire experts came in eventually and said, no, that analysis is wrong. We have a new way of looking at how fire spread.
That's true. That's the events that we have today.
Well, Victor Rosario, you have complete freedom now, not only freedom from incarceration, but freedom from a new trial. What's next for you?
Oh, for me, the sky is the limit. I just would love to go back to the prison system and to work with the guys inside to give the experience how to begin their life even inside the prison system, okay? And how the system has need to change. It's so many men inside the prison system that they are there and they never have any second chance, you know. And I think the American is built in second chance, and they don't have a second chance.
So if the local senator or the governor were to come to you and say, you were 32 years on the inside, we want your advice, what needs to change, what would you say?
I would say you need to start it first from the Department of Correction, what we call rehabilitation. Rehabilitation now is not rehabilitation. Now everything is public safety. And because it's public safety, it's two different agencies. And because it's two different agencies, operation inside is everything is public safety. Never give you a chance to the prisoners to come out and to work. You know, and I think there is time to start thinking that there is not only me that made 32 years. It's guys that have been in there 38 years, and you can see it. There is already out innocent man. Rehabilitation basically is to bring the person back in the same state of mind. I think that they need to start thinking in the other way. Every single prisoner that is in prison, in classification, in parole, the first word that come out from every single inmate is, I would like to be a productive member of society. What is going on? When you come out, the first thing that they say, you're a former prisoner. They keep you with that name. I think that they need to change. The reason why is because every single one in there representing one, representing a father, representing a family, representing a son, representing even a brother, and even a sister, a mother, a grandmother. That is the person that is inside the prison system. They are not animals. They are not numbers. They are human beings. They may errors, they committing whatever they committed, but they still be a human being. And I pray to the Lord, they give me the opportunity that one day I can go back and I let them know that it's really they can do it. They can do it. Say, I did it, they can do it. Say, I made the change in my life, they can do it also.
Victor Rosario spent 32 years in prison in Massachusetts for an arson that killed 8 people. He was released in 2014 and has just learned that the state will not try him again for that crime. Victor Rosario, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Roadside Attractions, presenting Stronger, starring Jake Gyllenhaal as Jeff Bowman, whose strength became a symbol of hope after a national tragedy, in theaters September 22nd. And Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for businesses, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage, and more. More details at Staples stores or staples.com/copy and print. Staples, it's pro time.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, and let's go to California now, where San Diego County is in the middle of a public health emergency. Over 300 people have been hospitalized and 15 have died in an outbreak of hepatitis A. The majority of those deaths have occurred since mid-July. Now, hepatitis A is a virus. It's typically spread through food or water contamination. And in this outbreak, about 70% of those thought to be infected are homeless people in San Diego. David Alvarez is a council member representing District 8 in San Diego. He joins me now to weigh in on the city's response to the outbreak. Councilmember Alvarez, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Describe the scope of the outbreak on your streets there in San Diego, if you would, please.
Yes, it is really a crisis. That an outbreak was recognized March 3rd of this year. It can be traced back to November of last year. You mentioned 15 deaths. Unfortunately, there's been a 16th death now. It is really catastrophic. We have seen this primarily in the homeless population, the most vulnerable individuals, and really it's a disaster here happening. I think this is probably the largest outbreak and certainly the largest number of deaths related to hepatitis A in the country. And unfortunately, health officials believe that this can continue for quite some time.
This outbreak, as we mentioned, is primarily affecting homeless people in your city. How are people getting it?
Well, it's being spread through fecal matter. The county health official has declared officially almost all of downtown at this point fecally contaminated. It is because homeless do not have access to shelter. They do not have access to restrooms. They do not have access to sanitation stations to wash their hands. And unfortunately, the county and the city really delayed in getting that out, those stations out into the public so that there would be access to these. Now, bathrooms have been made available at all public facilities. They've been open now for 24 hours. Bathrooms are going to hopefully be deployed. That's what I'm expecting and hoping. And the mayor just yesterday announced that we'll be putting up large-scale tents to try and bring some assistance. Unfortunately, the mayor's talking about doing this 3 months from now, which would be too late, as the incubation period, you know, is 15 to 50 days. The hepatitis A can live on for about 2 months outside of the body, and more individuals can become infected, unfortunately, between now and then. So I'm hoping we take more action sooner.
hand-washing stations. The city is now pressure-washing the streets to try to clean them off. Councilman Alvarez, there is a hepatitis A vaccine. Are people getting it?
Yes, the county is distributing that vaccine. It takes two dosages for hepatitis A. And the homeless are being offered, as is to the general public that comes into contact. And I think more and more individuals, adults who might not come into contact, are receiving the vaccine. There are cases, you mentioned, mostly homeless, but 25% roughly of the individuals who've been diagnosed with hepatitis A is the general public, if you will. So I think more and more people are becoming concerned and are looking to get the vaccine. But the vaccine will only go so far, and you have to take it, and you can't force someone to do that. So we need to have other measures in place to help to prevent the spread.
The city of San Diego is trying to respond to a hepatitis A outbreak on their streets, new bathrooms, new tents, hand washing stations, and pressure washing the streets as a hepatitis A outbreak spreads among the city's homeless population. David Alvarez, council member representing District 8, just informed us that a 16th person, unfortunately, has died in that outbreak. David Alvarez, thank you for the update.
Thank you.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick. And let's take a music break now here on The Takeaway. Listen with me to the Afrobeat sound of Antibalas. Antibalas has been on the scene for almost two decades, bringing their mix of jazz, funk, and improvisation to audiences all over the world. They follow in the footsteps of other Afrobeat legends like Fela Kuti. Fela Kuti was an activist, never shied away from politics, and neither does Antibalas. They've got a new album coming out tomorrow. It's called Where the Gods Are at Peace. A couple of members of Antibalas dropped by our studios here at The Takeaway. I sat down with Duke Amayo. He's the lead singer and percussionist, and also founder Martin Perna. We talked about the band's music and its meaning in this moment.
If we truly are mindful in the society we live in, we would always look out for our fellow brothers and sisters. A weird place to be, but as well as an opportunity to actually step up and do things that you've been preaching about, you know. So I think we are at a place now where we are actually activating all the things that we've been talking about for years.
There's so much opportunity to make conflict, you know, Twitter. It's really kind of the urge to pick a fight with someone about something that ruffles you and irks you. It's so easy to do these days. It's kind of irresistible, and so like Amaya was saying, what can we do as artists to try to refocus, starting with ourselves, something away from conflict? Because it kind of seems like if the world just keeps on going with Twitter fights and internet battles and then real world battles, that's not sustainable. It's going to be a very ugly end for all of us. As people who are creative, we need to get our imaginations working and try to think of different ways to frame. Like, tomorrow doesn't need to look like today.
Duke, this is Gold Rush. What are you going for here?
Let's go back and identify where things went wrong, or where we even are aware that things were going wrong. We basically just roll with our punches, roll with what was happening at that time, and, you know, then it became a thing, you know, and that thing grew into the system we have today, which is kind of like now starting to ask us to look back at, you know, where we came from.
The gold rush you're talking about here, yeah. 1500s, treatment indigenous. Of indigenous communities.
Yes. Indigenous peoples have seen so much of this sort of, you know, like in terms of like we open our arms to welcome you and all we get back is what's happening today.
That was a moment that a whole new utopic world could have been created of harmony. But there was an ethnocentrism of these people are savages, they don't know how to exploit, you know, all these riches that are around them. It's scary thinking about if the next 200 years are as violent and as bloody and as uncertain as the past 200 years. It's really scary because now we have the technology to, it's all happening so much faster, and then the environmental problems that have exacerbate all the consequences of that. So it's a really scary moment, I think.
Extra, extra. Truth is golden, shines forever.
In the 1800s, there was a cowboy named Coloma from a town called Gold Town, now Ghost Town. Coloma asked Chief Two Eagles, "Where did we go wrong?"
This is about the long arc of injustice that you guys see. Let's listen to Hook and Crook.
I went from Lagos to Badagry. I came upon a crossroad. To my left was permaculture. And to my right was a path of no return. So I meditated, revealed the ancestors. As I soared up Kilimanjaro, to gain an outwardly perspective, I realized I must detach from crooked hooks, detach from life's difficulties, detach, detach.
Basically, democracy began when the Portuguese and the British came in, realized how efficient the society was functioning, and how the roads were like, very easy to get through. At the same time, it expressed a certain kind of openness, and that openness was taken advantage of. The openness was, basically the same thing we have with the gold rush. You're open to the exchange of ideas become exchange of violence, basically.
I'll tell you the way in for me, for your music, guys, was when you started doing David Byrne. Played a little bit of his Afrobeat. He's got a long history of it, Talking Heads, and then in his solo career. I'm just one person, but for me, that was the way into Antibalas.
I mean, that's the interesting thing about Afrobeat is that there were, even from the, dating back to 1969, Fela Kuti and his group were in LA for 6 nights a week for 6 months playing in Hollywood. So that was this whole interchange of music. James Brown's musical arranger was going to see him. Stevie Wonder was checking him out, Sly and the Family Stone. So that was a really exciting point when Fela's music changed and American music changed. And we're sort of the result of that many years later.
Fela came and seeded it almost in America at that point, at that gig, that six-month gig in L.A.
In a sense, and I think also he was playing a much jazzier form, shorter compositions, much jazzier, and not as politicized. And that changed after his trip to the United States. The structure of the music has both discipline and freedom. There are parts that are pretty much always the same or very similar, and then other parts that are very elastic and unpredictable. One of the hardest things for us, I think, has been with the radio form, where most songs that are over 4 minutes don't get a full play, and the form of Afrobeat is a long-form music. It's the difference between a New Yorker article and a 350-page book about the same subject. And we're, pop music is the article, and we're, our songs are like the book about something.
I think you were a little bit generous to pop music there. I'm not sure if it's a New Yorker article. It might be a BuzzFeed list. I don't know. Yeah.
But as far as how deep you can get into a subject, if you only have, three 8-bar verses and 2 choruses, you're not really, it's going to be much more harder to kind of win over the audience, to bring them in, to kind of get them into this emotional state. And so much about Afrobeat is this kind of trance hypnotism, but also like a musical foreplay.
Antibalas came out pretty hard politically during the George W. Bush years. What about now? How are you feeling about politics now?
We started during Clinton, and we were really critical of Clinton. We've never sort of picked sides as far as parties, and it's more about ideas and values and what is threatening humanity and threatening how we can have chances to be better people.
The way we look at everything, from the way the politics is running today, the way we engage our politicians, not hating, just listening to detox, detach, all that kind of stuff. Retool and retrain is important, because we're retooling and retraining people for computers, but we're not retooling and retraining the political system or the people running the government. They're just trying to take us back to the old ways, rather than look ahead.
The new album is Where the Gods Are at Peace. It's Antibalas. Duke Amayo, lead singer, percussionist Martin Perna, founder. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Well, that's all for us today. But as always, we want to keep hearing from you. You can send your thoughts and your questions. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Todd Zwillick, and the show, too, at The Takeaway. And of course, we want you to give us a call at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can also find us on Facebook. Thanks so much for being part of this program. It's very important to us that you are. Until tomorrow, I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Indeed.com, where business owners and HR professionals can post job openings, review candidates, take notes, and schedule interviews from an online dashboard. Learn more at Indeed.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.